This is the Kinky Cast. This is an adult, sexually explicit podcast. If you are under 18 years old, please stop the podcast now. This is episode 43 of our weekly exploration in the kinky world of BDSM and alternative relationships. Views expressed are not representative of the management of the Kinky Cast. Today we chat with Mistress Lorelei. Here's our hosts Woody and the Beast.
Thanks, Max, and welcome to the Kinky Cast, a new edition, Beast. What do we got here?
We have a very exciting guest, one that I had to work really hard to locate, even though she was in plain sight the whole time. We have Mistress Lorelei Powers with us. Mine and Lorelei's association goes back about 2 decades now, isn't it?
Just about, yeah.
Yeah, she made the trip when she was out on the East Coast to my second wedding to be quite the surprise guest.
Wow, you are a lucky guy.
I have great, great friends, even if I lose track of them from time to time. Glad to have you with us, Lorelei.
It's great to be here.
Way of introductions, Mistress Lorelei Powers is internationally known authority on BDSM, especially femdom relationships. Her book, The Mistress Manual, which I consider the standard, explains both the practical details and the psychology of female dominance and male submission in an established relationship. She's also the author of The Charm School for Sissy Maids and the erotica collection On Display. A new story collection will be available in the spring of 2015, and she's currently writing a follow-up to the Mistress Manual. Quite the resume.
Well, thank you. I stayed busy.
It would seem so. Your book, The Mistress Manual, I consider that a must-read for everyone embarking on that type of relationship. Sadly, so few do read nowadays. And I still refer them to your book constantly. Tell us your story. How did you get into the lifestyle?
Oh, this is a long story because, you know, I've had years and years of adventure. I was always kinky, but growing up in a somewhat traditional household in a very fundamentalist community, it was really difficult to be the dom I really wanted to be. Very difficult. You know, all of that kind of thing is just crushed out of girls. You know, you're not supposed to ever be smarter than a man or beat him in any way. You know, you don't even beat him in a game of cards, much less, you know, take down his britches and beat his ass.
No, I love it.
Yes, and I grew up in a very similar, my grandparents were in the Pentecostal church.
Mm-hmm.
Mother stayed home, nuclear family. My parents are still married after all these years, and it was a very conservative. So I know exactly where you're coming from.
You know, as soon as I could, I left home. I went off to college and started having, you know, interesting sexual experiences. And after several years of that, I met my husband. He's now my ex-husband. But we had kinky sex before we ever had vanilla sex. You know, by that point, I was a little more comfortable with, you know, expressing my, you know, needs and desires. And, gradually I came to realize how powerful being a dominatrix felt to me, how profoundly linked to the core of my sexuality. You know, after a number of years of marriage, I sat down and wrote the Mistress Manual. There was very little available at that point in terms of information on sex.
You wrote the Mistress Manual. What year was that?
That was in 1993, and it was published in 1994. So it's actually 20 years old now.
Wow.
About time for an update.
And it's still in print, isn't it?
It is still in print and also available on Kindle. One of the lovely things about the march of technology has been that, you know, books that would have been, you know, too expensive to keep in print, like The Charm School for Sissy Maids, which I did a couple of years after that, it's not in print in the sense that you could no longer buy a physical copy, but it's definitely still available as an ebook.
So many people are reading the ebooks now anyway. That's what I have moved to. I find that it opens up so many new options. There's so much less investment needed for the publishing houses. They can take more risk with many more books now.
Yes, and also something like this, you can be living in, you know, Nowheresville, Iowa, or Tennessee, or even California. You know, wherever you are, you can download that book. You don't have to, you know, have a mail drop so that your spouse doesn't find out what you're reading. I mean, the world has changed enormously, and this helps.
Let's roll this back. Like myself, I think you went through college in the mid to late 80s, and you were finding that you were a woman on top. What was that like?
It was a little startling to me. I'm actually a bit older than that. I went to college in 1976. I went to a Christian college. But I was really startled to discover that there were kinky people there. I mean, one of the people I got very close to was a submissive man who asked me to dom him. I mean, and neither of us knew what we were doing. And I was involved with somebody else at the time, so we never did actually play. But, you know, the urge was still there, and other people recognized this in me long before I did.
It is interesting how we develop our radar for other kink-minded individuals over time. You know, now we can just look across a room oftentimes and, oh, that person's kinky by the most subtle things. So they realized you were. You said you met your husband in college, is that right?
No. I met my husband when I was out of college for several years. You know, we just instantly clicked. And again, that's partly because we were both kinky.
You were on the, which coast at this time?
Oh, I was living in the East. I never thought I would live in California.
And we'll get to the California story in a bit, I am sure.
I have a question here. How do you find somebody kinky? When you see them, it's like kinkdar or something. Is that how it works?
Well, actually, there is a scientific theory behind this. This is really true. I don't need to make this stuff up.
Okay, I like it.
When you look into someone's eyes, basically, you know, your eyes are part of your brain, and their eyes are part of their brain, so it's like your brains are almost touching each other, and you see certain patterns of emotion. This is what's behind love at first sight, which is something I very strongly believe in. At least it may not be love, but it's recognition. And the more far out you are off the average, the more likely you are, in my experience, to be able to find somebody, you know, just by looking at them, because you recognize those emotional patterns.
I've always said the eyes are the windows to the soul.
Yes, they really are. This is all discussed in a book called The Natural History of Love, and I've forgotten who wrote it, but you can look it up. It's a great book. It's really interesting. Just being able to recognize someone and knowing that you're kinky is not enough to sustain a relationship.
No, it's not.
It can be a spark to start things, but it's not going to be the whole thing. You have to work.
We talked to Nancy Ava Miller recently, and she was seeding BDSM clubs all over the country at this point, but we didn't really have clubs going on for the most part at that point. So meeting people was much more of a challenge, and revealing yourself was much more challenge, wasn't it?
Yes, it really has changed. I mean, these days you can meet people at bunches, you can go online and find people, you can go to clubs. There's a lot more available now. Although, again, still there's plenty of people who live in rural parts of the country or small towns and don't feel they can afford, you know, if you're a high school principal, you really probably should not be going to a sex club, you know, in your little town.
Probably so. Somebody eventually is going to recognize you and put two and two together, and the rumors will start flying.
Yes, and the job will go bye-bye.
Yes, and that's unfortunate that we still live in that world, isn't it?
It really is. But again, you know, if you're a high school principal, you can go on FetLife or any of the other, you know, places that are specifically designed for people with, you know, unusual sexual interests, whatever they may be.
You were married. You had developed a kinky relationship. with your now ex-husband. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
And the Mistress Manual grew from your experiences in that relationship?
Yes. And I also, by that point, I knew a few other women who were interested. And so I was able to incorporate not just my experiences, but those of some other women.
Tell us more about the book.
Well,
tell us enough to motivate people to want to read.
It's been so long since I did this. Basically, the Mistress Manual tells the reader how to figure out what your partner's kinks are, how to link them up and figure out the pattern of what they're interested in. For example, there are a lot of people who are into spanking of various sorts, and some are going to be interested in spanking as punishment, and some are going to really react badly to that idea. They don't do a punishment dynamic. And this book helps you figure out that kind of thing and basically tells you step by step how to put together a scene, how to carry yourself. And it is for the women who want to do kinky sex but just don't quite know how to get into the role. They can't access their inner dom.
So is this limited, though, to lifestylers, or is this for any couple that are wanting to explore the female-on-top relationship structure, whether it be casual or more serious?
Oh, definitely for anybody. You know, whether you want to do an occasional, you know, Saturday night bedroom BDSM, or whether you want to live the lifestyle 24/7, the book is helpful. And even if you're an experienced dom, there's always something else you can learn. I'm still learning things. It's wonderful.
This is a book, and it's a short book in the grand scheme of things.
It's 300 pages.
I consider that short. I've just come out of college. So I know some of my college tomes were 1,500 pages in one case. So I consider any book under 500 short nowadays. But it's a very informative
book. You're spoiled.
I am. It's a very informative book. How hard was it to get this book published?
I actually had some interesting experiences. Different Loving had just come out. Different Loving by Gloria Braham. I don't know if you know her, but if you don't, have her on your show. She's fabulous.
We did, and she was.
And Gloria was incredible.
She is wonderful. So I looked at that book. I said, you know, clearly it's possible to publish things, you know, on this, and checked out her publisher, essentially, you know, the man who was her editor. And he wrote me a lovely note and was like, yes, this is a really interesting book. This looks very good. Recommended a couple literary agents to me. One of them, you know, I went with one of them, and she shopped the book around New York, and everybody loved it.
Wow.
No one would publish it.
Aha.
Because it's one thing to write a book about people, as Different Loving is. I mean, Different Loving is a great book about real people, many of whom I know. You know, it talks about their lives and everything, but it doesn't say, well, this is how to do it. You can look at it as a book that, you know, is almost sociology. Look at these strange and interesting people. It's very different to say, hey, I'm one of those strange and interesting people, and you can be too.
Well, Different Loving had a lot of actual case studies in it, and that was the approach that they took. And for many people in the lifestyle today, it is not the type of book that they're used to reading because it's more clinical. The book you wrote is definitely not as clinical. It's more of a how-to manual.
Right. It is definitely a how-to manual, and that made it threatening. You know, after all of these promises and this agent was telling me, oh, we'll have an auction, you know, we're looking at six figures and so on, and I was left with nothing. And my own background, professionally speaking, is in editing as well as writing. I had worked in publishing for years. So I just said, the hell with it, and published it myself.
Wow, that was a bold move, self-publishing.
It has been extremely successful. After 3 years, I sold the book to Greenery Press because, again, Greenery Press is basically started the same way. Somebody who had a great, you know, great books that they had written about kinky sex and couldn't get them published, and so they started their own.
And we had Janet on our show back in the spring with the story of Green Repress. So yes, and it had a huge impact on the literature that we have to work with today. They did amazing stuff.
I am now writing and publishing with Renaissance eBooks. Barbary Coast Editions, I think, is what the books come out from. But my book of short stories came out first as an ebook. It's now available in print as well. They're lovely people to work with. I'm still on good terms with Janet, but I'm working with somebody else right now.
So your next book, was that the Charm School or was that the On Display?
Oh, the second book was the Charm School for Sissy Maids.
And that is a niche market for sure.
That is a niche market for sure, but you know what? That book still sells. There are still plenty of people who crave that approach.
There's a lot more people than we probably know about because it's a very closeted lifestyle.
True.
I would dare say that the sissy is probably the most closeted of the kinky people that we have. For whatever reason that is, many of them are older and struggling to come into the new age, I think, of kink.
There's that. I mean, they're struggling to come into the new age. Part of it is that they are challenging our definitions of masculinity and femininity. And that's hard, particularly since in my personal experience, which is, you know, extensive, decades of personal experience here, the kind of man who is a sissy is somebody who is presenting as extremely masculine in his day-to-day life. The number of cops, firefighters, defense contractors, lawyers, you know, trial lawyers, people who have extremely responsible and extremely macho jobs, and they're the ones who need to let down, you know, but with a sissy maid.
And for years in the early days, that's what we found. My second wife was a professional dame for a period of time. And many of her clients came from the most hard-driving, demanding male professions. And they needed that stress relief.
Yes, I actually was told by a friend who lived in Washington, D.C., that Dream Dresser, which is a I don't even know if it's still open. Dream Dresser, which is a store that sells fantasy and fetish clothing, that the one in Georgetown was always jammed on the day that the Congress let out.
Yeah, I can imagine. There's also a Dream Dresser in Los Angeles that's really good.
Yeah, there was one in New Jersey, there was one in L.A., and there's one in D.C. I actually don't have a sissy in my life right now, which is kind of unfortunate. So I'm not as up on where to get the goodies.
Many of our listeners are new to the lifestyle. And the sissy maid is different than the transgendered individual, isn't it?
Very much so.
Can you help our listeners, since you have lots of experience in this area, can you help differentiate the two?
The first thing to realize is someone who's transgendered has a different inner gender than the one assigned at birth. So that, you know, if you look at a baby and you see, you know, certain physical features, you say it's male or it's female. And for the transgendered person, you know, their inner experience of the world does not match the way other people see them. For someone who is a sissy, they're actually almost a third gender because they tend to want to surrender to a strong female. But what they are themselves is not female, but feminine. They are the opposite of masculine. Every macho stereotype you can think about goes to its opposite in the sissy. It's all soft and pink and frilly and perfumed. A sissy does not want to become a female. They want to pay tribute to femininity and basically get rid of the masculinity for a while.
Is this partially a spiritual journey for many of them?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, in many cultures, most of the Native American cultures and a number of other cultures around the world, men who transformed into women were often priests. If you've ever read The White Goddess by Robert Graves, he talks about it in old European cultures, this sense of worshiping woman. And the part of the way that men did that was by, you know, dressing up.
Well, I'm of the opinion, and I'm not sure how my anthropologist would agree, that the first beings worshipped was the female for her reproductive
capacity. Yeah, you have to admit, it's totally magical. But a woman can take a little bit of, you know, bodily exudates and mix them up in her body, and, you know, 9 months later, there is another separate human being.
It is a mystical thing.
It is a mystical thing. And so by
even our 21st century.
Yeah, by trying to honor femininity, sissies, you know, are really doing something daring and brave.
Now, sissies also come in several flavors. There are some that are into the humiliation factor, which is a different breed than the ones that are honoring the femininity, possibly. But it is a broad fetish, isn't it?
It's a very broad fetish, and that's a bad pun.
So you wrote The Charm School for Sissy Maids, and this is targeted at both the sissy and is usually female partner?
Yes. It's also available for a sissy who doesn't have a female partner but wants to learn and grow and develop the skills necessary. And I don't just mean skills in curtsying or walking in high heels, although those are useful.
And many of the, at least from my early days in this lifestyle, many sissies did not have a partner.
That's true. It was extremely difficult.
I remember the very brave, daring gentlemen that would come to the club and transform themselves very carefully, with varying degrees of skill. It was a total transformation that they made in this space, and how much more alive they were after the transformation than when they often slunk into the play space to begin with. It was quite magical.
Magical is exactly the word. And of course, again, this is the source of some extremely powerful sex magic. You know, if you do that sort of thing, this is one of the ways to do it.
So gender is an important component there.
It's important, but it's complicated.
It's complicated. That it is. And this third gender that you were speaking of, now we're gender fluid. Is even third accurate, or is it much more complex today?
I think it is much more complex in terms of people being willing to recognize multiple genders. There are plenty of people out there who identify, you know, as gender fork, or, you know, there's a dozen different ways you can describe your gender. You know, there's also a lot of people still raised in very traditional societies who were presented with that forced choice, or even, it's not even a choice, it's like, you are a boy, therefore you must like football, therefore you must, you know, be macho and not cry, and the only emotion you're allowed is anger.
Well, it wasn't a choice, it was a simple assumption. That's the way it is.
Yes, and it is enforced, and it is still enforced by violence. People who overstep the bounds of what a man is supposed to do or what a woman is supposed to do are still often the targets of physical and emotional violence.
I was listening to an NPR piece on the way into the studio tonight, and it was about a new play that a Chicago playwright put together that's now being put together on in Minneapolis, of all places, that discusses this through the eyes of a football team.
Interesting.
So he is talking about the ultra-machoism of football and how it is coloring the sexual identity of men. And he's a gay male that wrote it, and it has all of the explorations. And the lead character is not even a football player. He's a man in a wheelchair. And how this football is further taking his masculinity away from him, because of his inability to participate.
Interesting.
So you're right. That is our culture. It's men are macho and violent.
Yeah. And women have to learn their place. Mm. I mean, if you spend any time online, you're probably aware of the death threats, the rape threats, and so on, that are experienced by women who dare to be experts. It's a real issue.
Now, you are a feminist.
Oh, yes.
You're also a queer activist.
Very much so. You know, just because I play with boys doesn't make me heterosexual.
I believe you are a sexual person. Is that the correct term?
You could say that. Actually, I have to tell you, I am a zombie sexual.
New term.
I go for brains.
Ah.
I've never heard that before, but I really like it.
I made it up.
Well, we will have to be sure that that gets copyrighted and attributed to you. So it's the mind that you're going for.
It's the mind that I'm going for, yes. And I came out, this is the old lesbian sense of, I had my first sexual experience with a woman before I was 21, but I had known from the beginning that I was bisexual. I never had a heterosexual identity. You know, I always had crushes on both girls and boys. It was never, you know, boys are the only ones who count for me.
You were quite the sexual firebrand in college, weren't you?
Oh, God, yes. And this is not a good thing to be when you're a Baptist, okay? And at a Baptist college.
No, I can imagine that was quite the conflict. Being in slacks in a Baptist college was probably controversial enough.
We were a little more liberal than that, but being a fiery feminist was difficult.
There was not a course in feminism in the curriculum, I'm willing to bet.
No, there was not.
So this was a very interesting time. You really blazed your own trail.
Yeah, I had to. Remember, this is the late 1970s where the Anita Bryant campaign against gays was extremely powerful and, you know, to kind of taking over the airwaves. I was in college when Harvey Milk was murdered for being, basically for being gay. And
yeah,
it was so hard. It was so hard for all of us.
Anita Bryant, for our listeners, she was a Miss America. Is that correct?
She had been a Miss America.
And she took on the campaign against homosexuality with great fervor and excitement. And she just got a lot of press because of her position.
Right. She was also a spokeswoman for orange juice. There was this whole thing of, I remember bumper stickers, kill a queer for Christ, with, you know, three little oranges on it.
We were reliving this terrible, tragic history for our younger listeners, because I think it's important that these stories be remembered so we don't repeat these things again. So these are the Reagan years.
Yes.
A great time, not in American history. So you get through the 70s, you get through the 80s. I met you in the 90s.
Yes, and the world opened up.
You were working as a counselor for Nancy Eva Miller.
Yes, I was.
Always thought was powerful and great work you all did on those phone lines in those days, giving in places that didn't have other options at least some outlet and a sympathetic ear and a bit of understanding.
Yes, you know, practical help, information, and just the knowledge that you're not alone. I don't want anybody to suffer the way I suffered growing up, feeling like I was the only person who wanted these things.
Now, you have been kinky for nearly two decades at this point. Is that right?
More than that.
From the mid-70s to the mid-90s.
No. I was kinky from the beginning.
I was having
extremely detailed and graphic sexual fantasies, you know, from childhood on. And even when I didn't realize I was kinky, I was doing kinky things. When I was 16, I had a boyfriend who was 27, which now I look back and say, my God, I can't believe my mother allowed this. But there was one day that we were in the living room at my grandparents' house, and I had him, you know, kneeling on the floor and sitting up and begging and playing dead. I was playing with him as though he were a puppy. And my grandfather was extremely upset. I mean, until the end of his life, for the next, you know, 25 years, he was angry with me about that.
Wow. And this was things coming out of your own imagination. You didn't have access to the literature, the internet, or anything we have today.
Nothing.
And I remember having similar, rather colorful fantasies that had no seed. They're just coming from my own imagination in those early, early years. And just interesting indeed that we just came up with them.
Right.
So in the 90s, you're working for the telephone line. You've got books coming out. And you've been at this for a number of years. And then the internet changes everything for us all, didn't it?
Oh, yes. And it was wonderful. In fact, that's how I met my partner. That's how I met my girlfriend. We were on a CompuServe forum called HSX for Human Sexuality. And we were part of a, you know, sort of a sub-forum called 12B, which was for, you know, people who are interested in BDSM.
Wow, these cryptic things. And this was a text-only service back then.
It was text-only, although you could upload photographs to the library, but that was complicated and most people didn't. It was text. I made some of my closest friends there.
CompuServe was a real gathering point for people that had all kinds of different fetishes back well into the 70s.
Oh, yeah. I think the forum finally shut down when CompuServe shut down, but that was actually into the early 2000s when they finally shut down. It was a great place to meet people because it was text-based and very, very discussion-heavy, a number of lasting relationships. I mean, there was one year we had 14 marriages, not 14 people getting married, but 14 marriages.
Wow.
Of people who had met on the forum.
Wow, that's an amazing, considering the much smaller population that was using the internet than we have today.
Yeah.
You met your current partner on the internet, is
yes.
that right?
Yes.
And you and her have been together how many years?
16 years.
16 years. Wow. That's amazing. So I presume there must have been a divorce in there.
There was a divorce in there, not because of the new relationship. It was essentially a lot of different things came to a head.
This relationship, it carried you across the country though, right?
Yes, I came to California specifically to be with my new partner.
And what a change that must have been for you.
Yes, yes. I'm still kind of shocked. There are days that I'm still astonished that I got to California.
It's a different world?
It's a different world. Everything is different. And one of the things that happened when I got here, I settled in to a life where I was normal.
Oh, Matt.
Okay, not everybody here is queer, but everybody here knows somebody who is queer. Everybody here knows people who are kinky. It's taken for granted. And I have actually spent much of the time since I got here, I moved out here in 2001, just like enjoying family life in a world where it's okay to be polyamorous, it's okay to be kinky. About 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago, I got involved with a man. My poly family at first called him Mr. Vanilla. Because it's like, what are you going to find to do with this guy? He's vanilla. Well, it turns out he's not vanilla. He's not a submissive, but he's not vanilla. And so we've had some interesting times exploring various things. But this is, you know, this is all kind of normal, and I haven't felt the need for being active in the community for a long time.
But I have noticed that you're coming back out of your self-exile now. I have noticed your threads are being more common now.
I went to an erotic hypnosis conference, which was wonderful. Oh, my God, it's so exciting. And met a lot of younger people, new in their kink, some people who are much younger than me. I mean, there was a speaker there who was 22 and who was brilliant. And, you know, various other people ranging in age up to, you know, 20 years older than me. And it was like such an interesting, exciting experience to be with people again who were not just living the kinky life, but who were thinking about it and talking about it. I realized that I miss the community. I miss being involved with my local kink community as opposed to just sort of living. I mean, I live across the bay from San Francisco. The only time I go to Folsom Street Fair these days is if I'm actually, you know, part of the entertainment. If I'm doing a scene, say, for my publisher.
So if you're making a public appearance.
Yeah, if I'm making a public appearance. And now it's like, well, you know, it's not enough just to be living the lifestyle. Although it's wonderful. Don't get me wrong. A day-to-day life with my submissive is heaven. We deal with ordinary problems and some occasional extraordinary problems, but basically I am profoundly emotionally satisfied by this relationship. But, you know, I've been a little selfish.
And it's great that it doesn't have to be so much in the closet as it was in prior years and prior locations.
Oh, God, yes. I mean, my husband was so closeted. It was heartbreaking.
Well, it was a different time and a different place, though.
Yeah, well, and also a different person.
True.
You know, he probably is still closeted. I understand his new wife is kinky, which I think is lovely, and I hope they're very happy.
There's somebody for everybody. You have one more book out there, already printed, on display.
Yes, that's a series of erotic short stories, basically exploring a lot of different ways that you can be kinky. It is femdom in one sense because all of the women characters have power and use their power, but some of them are switches, and it's not all male submission either. I mean, there's a great Sissy Maid story in there. It's a wonderful story. I love it.
I am sure that one would call to you. Yes.
Yes, but there's also a number of other stories about lesbian couples, about people who are polyamorous, about, you know, a kinky artist, an older woman in New York who has a stable of interesting younger submissives. I mean, that's a great one. I love that story. So, you know, it explores all sorts of things.
So when did this collection hit the presses?
Well, it's been out for 2 or 3 years as an ebook, and it was just published as a standalone, you know, physical book, printed on paper.
So do the stories kind of reflect the progression of your life over the years?
That's an interesting way to think about it. I would say probably to some extent, but I hope that that's not true of the second volume, because the second volume has got, like, you know, dragons in it. And, you know, as much as dragon fantasies are interesting, I don't actually want to meet one anytime soon.
Well, you're a Game of Thrones fan, I'm sure then, right?
Actually, no.
No?
Never seen it, never read the books.
Oh, my. That's interesting. George R.R. definitely created an interesting world. The follow-up to the Mistress Manual, is it in the works?
It is in the works. I am actually currently writing it. I'm working on all the different things that didn't get discussed in the Mistress Manual, such as, okay, how do you deal with the various forms of polyamory, whether you're in, you know, serious committed relationships with multiple people, or whether you just play with, you know, strangers occasionally, or with your, you know, with your friends' partners. It includes the very different psychology of playing with women. There are a lot of differences between playing with a guy sub and a fem sub.
A lot of differences.
A lot of differences, and you can have so much fun. Yeah.
And the differences are also depends on the gender of the top on the interactions. There are so many combinations.
There are so many combinations, yes. I've met so many people who, like, occupy unique places in the gender world and in the kink world. There are men who are dominant and go into a scene but do the whole scene cross-dressed as a woman. And they're the dom, and they're a femdom. And I just think this is totally cool.
Yeah, why not?
And then they go back to being a man.
Yes, why not?
Exactly. It's just like there's so many different people to be.
So you're coming back out into the community. We're glad to have you back. I've noticed you got on our website will be a series of links for our listeners to visit. And I see you have a Tumblr account. And that account, you explore a lot of different topics?
Yeah, the Gallery of Dangerous Women. is the name of the Tumblr. If you just go to Tumblr and type in Ms. Lorelei, you will find me. And that's basically queer activism, social justice. I do a lot of things, you know, exploring, you know, gender relations and, you know, how do you deal with the patriarchy and so on. And then occasional photos of guys tied up and having their balls tortured. So it's a little unusual.
You're still the sick, twisted woman that I remember.
Oh, God, yes. And yeah. I love it.
And I say that with such great affection. Has I shield my private parts.
Yeah, it's funny how so many men, you know, suddenly cross their legs and turn green when I start talking about CBT.
I can't imagine why. Lorelei, yes. It's incredible to have you coming back into our community. I think you have so much to share with the community. And I really thank you for coming to visit with us tonight.
Well, thank you. It's been great to be here.
I am sure that we'll probably be hearing more from you, hopefully when you have some new books hitting the presses, so we can tune our listeners into those.
Oh, definitely. Yes. You will hear from me. Now that you found me, God, you're stuck with me.
it's such a good thing, isn't it?
I am a lucky man.
There it is.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Go out and have fun.
It is called play, you know.
It is called play.
It is called play.
We've been talking with Mistress Lorelei Powers, the author of The Mistress Manual and several other books. Please research her and enjoy her books.
And find them on our hot links.
And they're on our hot links.
Oh, great. Thank you.
You have been listening to episode 43 of The Kinky Cast. The Kinky Cast is a production of Rooster in the Round. Next week we chat with Phantom Blue and Slave Sherry. On behalf of Woody and the Beast, I'm Max.